The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Morning glory, America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm not there. I'm actually in the air flying to Europe because I've got a report on the French presidential campaign. That's my story, and I'm sticking with it. Actually, we're doing a listener cruise. Generalissimo is with me, and we're off to cruise from Paris down to Omaha Beach, and I'm looking so forward to it. We will be broadcasting from the boat. We'll be broadcasting from French soil. Of course, I'll bring you the latest on the French election. But in to fill for me as we fly, the one and the only Colonel Kurt Schlichter, who will bring you up to date on everything that happened in Ukraine over the weekend. Take it away, and thank you, Colonel Kurt.
Thank you, Hugh Hewitt. This is Kurt Schlichter here at the Relief Factor Studio in beautiful Southern California. At oh dark 30, not zero dark 30, you civilians, you Hollywood hacks, it's oh dark 30. How do I know? Among other things, and I will list my staggering CV, my resume, if you will. I'm a retired United States Army infantry colonel. I am not a JAG, though I am a noted Los Angeles trial lawyer. I'm also a senior columnist at townhall.com. We will be checking in on that. I have a memorable new column that has gone up already today at townhall.com. You ought to check it out. In my own incomparable way, it is titled Defending American Democracy Requires We Start by Crushing Public School Weirdos. So I'm sure we're going to get to that too. Because as you might notice, how do I put it? I was a cavalry officer, among other things, as an infantry officer. Yes, currently a cavalry battalion commander, squadron commander, is coded for infantry. So I can be infantry and command a cavalry squadron, which I did. And that's where I met Hugh Hewitt. He came to one of our cavalry balls, and he drank grog out of a cavalry Stetson. But I screen, as it were, Hugh Hewitt's right flank. So anyway, townhall.com columnist, senior columnist every Monday, Wednesday, and Thursday. And I also do a fun little stream of courteousness video every Friday. And, of course, I do a podcast for you VIPs. That's out today. I did a long thing on Elon Musk drawing on my legal skills. Now you're saying, wait a minute, Kurt, are you an expert in corporate governance law? Of course I'm not. That doesn't stop lawyers from shooting their mouths off about things they don't know about. But a little later this week, I am going to bring you a expert on that from the University of Chicago, I hope. And we will see how that works out, because I am here today. I'm here tomorrow. We're going to skip over Wednesday, and then I'm going to be back Thursday, and then I'm going to be back next week on Tuesday. And the whole time I am going to be shamelessly pushing my new book from Regnery, which is called We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America. Comes out July 12th, but you should go immediately pre-order We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America. I just got the proofs back. What they do is they print the book up after you go through regular edits, and then the author gets to look at it again and make all sorts of changes. And there were lots of changes because lots of stuff has been going on. Now, the Fall and Rise of America talks about a lot of very similar things to what we'll be talking about today. It talks about, the potential for conflict, how our country's kind of fallen apart, and where we're going to go in the future. And I had to update. I had to update stuff about Ukraine in particular. Let's get our little rundown here of what's going on in Ukraine. Airstrikes using missiles, not dumb bombs. Airstrikes in Kiev, which is the capital. Apparently, they hit a truck depot, a tank repair depot overnight, which is actually very important. It's a very good target because the Russians seem to be abandoning a lot of armored vehicles. And those armored vehicles have to be taken back to the depot, fixed up, and then they can be recycled because, of course, the Ukrainians use old Russian equipment, or actually more Soviet equipment. A lot of the weapon systems that the Russians are using pretty much came from the time of the Soviet Union. You know, you get your T-64s, T-72s, T-80s, T-90, I think, is after the fall of the Iron Curtain. And I was actually in Germany as a member of our armed forces when the wall fell. So I'm actually a Cold War vet. I was trained up let's be direct, to kill Russians. That's what my entire generation was trained to do, was kill Russians and destroy formations using Russian equipment, Russian tactics, which was proven in the Persian Gulf War, which I'm also a veteran of. I ran a heavily armed car wash. The Iraqis used Russian equipment. They used Russian tactics. And our forces, which my unit, which was 7th Corps, came from Germany. It was supposed to fight the Russians. Russians never showed up, went to Iraq, and holy cow, just destroyed the entire Iraqi army in about 100 hours. It's pretty amazing. Later in my career, I would deploy to Kosovo with a Polish-Ukrainian battalion. I also trained Ukrainians in Ukraine as part of the Cal Army National Guard 4 times over the years. So I have a little bit of knowledge of this. I went to Yaroslavl training area, which is outside Lviv. Lviv was also struck overnight by long-range missiles. I'm guessing caliber with a K, cruise missiles, killed 7, wounded many more. I'm not sure what the target was there. From what I saw on the footage, it looks like just regular civilian buildings. Seems like a waste of a pretty important weapon system. But, you know, the Russians aren't known for subtlety. They're not known for discernment. They're known for blowing everything up. And what we're seeing in Mariupol, which is a town on the Black Sea, the last holdout kind of in the land bridge between the Crimean incursion and the Donbas region, is Russian, classic Russian tactics, and classic tactics by the Ukrainians fighting the Russians. Now, the town of Mariupol has been essentially leveled. The footage there is rather stunning. This is what Russians do. If you look at what they did in Chechnya, if you look at what they did in Syria, when they can't take a town, they blow it up. Now, interestingly, the Ukrainians are kind of hearkening back to what's arguably one of the high points in Russian military history, which was the stand at Stalingrad against the German army. And Stalin said, no retreat. The Germans, for reasons that include the vanity of Hitler, he wanted to take the town named after Stalin, stop their advance in order to try and take this town. They leveled the town, including a bunch of factories, and the Russians dug in the ruins and fought it out. And they fought the Germans to a standstill. That's what the Ukrainians are trying to do in Mariupol. In Mariupol, their last redoubt, their last stand, is in something called the, and I'm going to try and pronounce it right, Azovstal Metalworks. It's a metal factory, very big, lots of furnaces and buildings and lots of tunnels. And it's very hard to dig these guys out. So they're still fighting there. Russians haven't taken it. Will it fall? It may fall, or these guys may keep fighting. And as long as they're fighting, they're holding up the Russians. As long as they're holding up the Russians, Russians are going to have to devote combat power to that as opposed to pushing around the forces that are in the salient that faces the Donbas. You look at a map, and a lot of the moves are pretty obvious for what you'd like to do if you could. But the problem for the Russians, and there's a number of problems, is that they're incapable of the kind of high-op-tempo, highly mobile conventional warfare that Americans at least used to be really, really good at. Okay, we haven't had to do that for a while. We've been chasing guys in technicals around the Hindu Kush for so long that I'm hoping we haven't lost our skills in moving armored forces quickly across the battlefield to seize the initiative, get inside the air guy's decision cycle, and be victorious. Now, Russians have a lot of problems. They're not well-trained, many of them. They're not well-led. You know, we keep hearing about how these generals are getting killed. I think they killed the 8th general. Look, you know, you're not getting a lot of tears out of me about flag officers buying the farm. But one might think, well, at least they're leading from the front. Well, you know, a general doesn't need to be leading from a front. General needs to be coordinating the symphony that is a combined arms force. Okay? You don't need to be out there with a bayonet going, follow me! All right? If you're losing 7 guys, eight generals, it means they're having to be up there to assert command and control. That seems to me to be a problem. We are back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I am guest host Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at townhall.com, retired United States Army colonel. What else am I? Holy cow. Noted a Los Angeles trial lawyer and the author of the upcoming book, We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America from Regnery. It's coming out in July. You need to pre-order We'll Be Back, The Fall and Rise of America right now. It's got national divorce. It's got talk about civil war. It's got why guns are important. It's got speculation on what the next president of the United States, who's going to be a Republican, should do to subdue and break the spirit of the damn communists who are trying to turn our country into a smoking heap of garbage. And on that note, there's nobody angrier, nobody more bitter, nobody more ready to take the fight to the enemy than my Irish American pal, Michael Walsh. Michael, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
Top of the morning to you, Colonel.
Oh, you bitter leprechaun, you. And author of many great books, by the way, the last one being Last Stands, which I found among my father's effects when I was cleaning out his office the other day. A great testimony to a great book. I really enjoyed Last Stands. You should all go get it when you're pre-ordering. We'll be back.
Excellent. Well, now, thank you very much for that compliment.
Well, Michael, now, of course, you have written 17 or 18 books. You've actually lost count. As I have been writing books, I think this is my 10th. You have been a mentor to me with great advice like get out there and promote the hell out of it and don't write so much stuff. Write shorter and better. So we'll keep that going. Michael, I am concerned about our country. I'm concerned about these damn communists trying to turn us into a third world backwater. Are you pessimistic or optimistic? And being Irish, I can guess which it is.
Well, yeah, as you know, Ireland, you always assume the worst is going to happen, even when the best is about to happen. So that's part of our national character. But we should mention, I think some of our listeners know this, I spent a lot of time in communist countries.
Yes, you did.
Dying communist countries.
That's the best kind.
Well, it is, except when you're actually there. Because here's the thing, ladies and gentlemen in Radio Land, they stink to high heaven.
Michael, as you know, I was in the Cold War and I later served years behind the Iron Curtain, whether in former Yugoslavia and in Ukraine. And you are absolutely right. There is this kind of industrial cleanser, grimy miasma in the atmosphere. It's kind of horrible.
No, it is horrible. And I said to people, after I got back, I was in the East Bloc countries between 85 and the collapse of the Soviet Union in 91, that if you put me down in a communist country blindfolded and you know, wearing earmuffs, the smell alone will tell me where I am. And I know that sounds like a silly thing, but it actually isn't, because it tells you it's this dying, rotting beast that these people have been trapped in. And yet the ones who want to force it upon us never seem to notice the stink. It's almost like the opening line, which I can't repeat on the air, but by a playwright I know I love, I think you do too, David Mamet, the opening line of Act Two of Glengarry Glen Ross about train compartments. You just don't notice it. And I think they just don't notice it. but the rest of the people do. And it's made up of a lot of elements, but despair is one of them. And if you've ever smelled despair, then you've been in East Berlin in the 1980s or in Moscow in 1990.
Michael Walsh, do you despair for our country?
Yes, I do. I do. I think, as you know, my own escape plan is well underway. I can fortunately go home to Ireland, where my great-grandmother was born, where I have rebuilt her house, and it's a very lovely and pleasant place for an old man to be. I think America has gone almost to the end, which is why this next election is so important. And yes, I know Sean Hannity always says it's the most important election of our lifetimes. But in a way, we've been in a sequence of unimportant elections. We've had a series of presidents who are all on the same side, starting with George W. H.W. Bush, and then Clinton, and then Bush, and then Obama. They're all more or less center middle, always moving leftist, though, always moving to the left. You see how leftist the Bushes were now in retrospect, and I think we all feel we've been had by them. President Trump was the first president that began to push the needle to the other in the other direction. We wish it had gone better. We wish he had been reelected. He wasn't, but now we're up against it. Luckily, their party is as stinky and dying as the old communists were. There are a bunch of geriatrics who are really clueless as to how to go forward because they don't have much of a future. And our party has now got some very young and vibrant people in it. And that gives me some hope for optimism. But the big culture has been badly, badly damaged by these people.
Well, Michael Walsh, I agree with you. And that's the subject of my book. We'll be back, The Fall and Rise of America. But by the title, you see that I'm much more optimistic than you are. Maybe it's because I'm a little bit younger, or maybe it's because I was, you know, knocked on the head a couple times in basic training. But I think we come out of this. Because I can't imagine losing to these people. How old is Nancy Pelosi? What is she, like 86?
Well, she's in her 80s. Dianne Feinstein is pushing 90. Biden is almost 80. You cannot run a country that's a gerontocracy. There's one of the elements of Gulliver's Travels by Swift, which people don't they think of the Lilliput and Brobdingnag section, but not the later ones. And one of them, he goes to a land in which people are immortal. That's the good news. The bad news is they age absolutely normally, like everybody else. So by the time they're in their 70s, the bits are falling off. By the time they're 80, they're getting slowing down. By the time they're 90, they're decrepit. And by the time they're 300 years old, imagine what they look like. But they cannot die. And we now have a gerontocracy, a Swiftian gerontocracy, of people who absolutely refuse to go gently into that good night and want to keep hammering us forever. I mean, that's bad on the Republican side, too. How old's Grassley? He's in his high 80s now. But as I say, at least we have some young blood that looks very promising.
Well, in the election of 2024, we are likely to see President Trump, who will be 68 at the time of the election.
No, 78.
Excuse me, 78.
Yeah.
Holy cow, that's a significant difference. He'll be 78.
You'll be 68 at the time of the election.
I will not be 68. I will just barely be getting my military pension. But the most likely candidate, and I think he pretty much has to run, is Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who's doing great things. Ron DeSantis is in his mid-40s. And Donald Trump, you know, I mean, Donald Trump's going to be an older guy. I saw him recently. He looks great. He's lost weight. He is not a staggering dust puppet like our current pseudo-president.
Yeah.
But he's still 78.
Yeah. Well, I'm 72, and I can tell you that being 72 is not like being 42, which I think DeSantis is 41 right now. He'll be 43 at the time of the election. There's this worry, and I think the baby boomers have pushed this on people, you know, that you got to be ready for it. You don't have to be ready for anything. Anyone who's ever done anything in their lives did it relatively young. I became the chief classical music critic and later foreign correspondent of Time magazine when I was 31 years old. So I had already worked my way up through the minor leagues and got to the show at 31. And I felt it was late for me. So, I mean, a lot of people think, oh, well, DeSantis hasn't been experienced in foreign policy. He's a governor. that's not his brief right now. When he gets to be president, it will be, and I think he'll do a very good job of it.
Well, if I recall, Marilyn Monroe's or one of her boyfriend JFK was about 43, and like DeSantis, a veteran, when he became president.
That's correct. He was 43. He was the youngest elected president. Bill Clinton was in his 40s when he was elected president. I think earlier presidents have been in their 40s. The Constitution makes it 35. And to the 18th century men, a man of 35 was a grown man. He had probably been a military veteran. He had certainly been a pioneer in some respects. He was in a brand new country. You were grown up in those days. And the idea that adolescence gets to extend into your 40s now is just another thing the left is trying to push on us to keep us helpless and obligated and unfree. And that's the thing we have to wake America up about. I've tried, obviously, in The Devil's Pleasure Palace, I told readers
great
all
book.
About the Frankfurt School and what critical theory is. And now you're seeing it, people. In A Fiery Angel, I gave you some alternatives to the leftist push against the high culture of the West. And Last Stands was about what makes them fight when all is lost. And the new book, which I can announce, is called A Rage to Live, A Time to Die. And it's about pivotal battles, most of which you've never heard, that completely changed the world in the blink of an eye. That's how important these things are.
Ooh, I'm looking forward to that. What's that again? Share the title.
A Rage to Live, A Time to Die.
You know, Last Stands, A Rage to Live, Devil's Pleasure Palace, Fiery Angel, these great books by you, Michael Walsh. You seem to hearken back to a time, you know, when men were men and women were women and life had meaning.
Well, I think that's a good time, and that's called history. You know, this whole notion that men could be girls and, you know, like with Kink Sing and Lola, you know, boys could be girls and girls could be boys, et cetera. That's a new world we don't want to be part of. It doesn't work historically. It's insane, for one thing, and we're dealing with people with severe mental illness at this point. I'm not necessarily saying go back to all the bad things of the old days, but we got here for a reason, and we ought to dance with what brung us.
Well, what brung us was Western civilization, and I think we ought to celebrate it, and I think we need to celebrate American history, and I don't think we need to apologize for American history in the sense that, you know, all peoples have good times, all people have bad times, there are people who've done good things, there are people who've done bad things, we've inherited it, but it's not our place to apologize, we didn't do it. It's what we do now that matters.
Right. We go, look, you're only responsible for your own actions. You're not responsible for the past. And you try to set up a future in which good things will happen. That's our duty as human beings.
Well, blood cannot be corrupted, Michael Walsh. It cannot. That's a savage and uncivilized way of being, and we're just not going to accept it. I'm Kurt Schlichter, here, sitting in for the great Hugh Hewitt. That was Michael Walsh. Go get his book, Last Stands, Fiery Angel, Devil's Pleasure Palace. Great stuff. Get mine. We'll be back, The Fall and Rise of America. And I'll be back here with Selena Zito in just a moment.
I want to remind you that our sponsor is AndrewandTodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to AndrewandTodd.com or call them at 888-888-1172.
We are back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. Why are we playing this this acoustic favorite from The Sound of Music? Well, I'm going to tell you in just a second when we're joined by our guest, Selena Zito. I want to talk to you guys, though. 800-520-1234. Talk about anything. Ukraine, student loans, Title 42, whatever you want next hour, 800-520-1234. Selena, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt radio program. Why am I playing Edelweiss?
Probably because of the story I wrote this weekend about a gentleman turning 100 years old in a couple days, and he came from Austria.
Frank, tell us a little about Frank Buchmann, Selena Zito.
Frank Buchmann was born April 22nd, 1922, in Austria, a small town of St. Martin. And at the time, Austria was in, it was right after World War One. Austria was incredibly impoverished. The country was going through some incredible post World War One economic upheaval, and you know the royal family was gone, and the entire country was just collapsing. And so his father came to the United States and eventually brought his young family. They came here for opportunity. They came to Pittsburgh. They came for opportunity. They came for a better life. And that's exactly what they achieved.
Well, Selena, everybody should check out the article From Austria to Pittsburgh in 100 Years, Community Sustains a Centenarian on the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Or they should get your newsletter, which I get. And that's how I found it this morning. I thought it was a wonderful article about a real American. Now you and I are Pennsylvania homies.
Yeah.
we are both descended from Pennsylvania stock. I'll tell you a little interesting story. As you know, my father, who was born in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, passed away about 2 weeks ago, suddenly, from pneumonia. Well, somebody online decided he would do some research into my family, some genealogical research, which kind of gives you faith back in social media. He sent me an article from a Chambersburg area paper from 1902 about my grandfather, great-great-great-grandfather Jacob Schlichter, who was a veteran of the Civil War. As an elderly man, he also died of pneumonia, brought on suddenly out of the blue. Just kind of fascinating.
It is. Fascinating. That was also quite kind of that person. That was very nice.
Well, look, I think people are generally nice, Selena. And mm-hmm. I think that you're one of those people who goes out and you actually talk to normal people while people, you know, the Washington Post, for instance, was advertising for their own version of Margaret Mead, who was going to go out amongst the savages and report back to civilized folks on their doings and transpirings. You actually go out and talk to people as if they're human beings.
I do. Well, first of all, I don't live in D.C. or New York. I live in the Paris of Appalachia. I live in the Pittsburgh area. So I think that in itself keeps me grounded. But I don't fly. I don't even use interstates. I take the back roads. That keeps me connected and understanding what's happening in the country in the most granular way. And I think what the lesson to be learned from Frank Buchmann, and you, everyone can check it out at selenazito.com. But I think that the thing that is most important, I asked him what he attributed his longevity to, and he said, "Oh, community. That's the most important thing. A sense of being part of something bigger than ourselves, of being together." And he said, "And I think that's what our obligation is as the elders, is to remind young people that that is the best of who we are." It's when we work together.
Well, Selena, what is the mainstream, or as I like to call it, regime media, missing about America that you're seeing when you go out and actually talk to Americans between the coasts?
Well, I think part of the problem in our major newsrooms is the majority of the people that work in them come from this sort of super zip codes of our country, right? From centers of wealth and power. There's nothing wrong with that. However, that does give you a different viewpoint. And I think newsrooms are also filled with people that went to the same Ivy League schools. There's not people that went to a community college or state college. I mean, up until Watergate, most journalists didn't even go to college, but what made them really, really good at their job was that they lived in their community They understood their community. They cared about their community. And I think that's the problem with more national news coverage of local issues.
Well, Selena, we got about 15 seconds left. Really quickly, are we going to, is the mainstream media going to be surprised about what happens in November?
That'd be an affirmative.
Oh, I love that. My friend, Selena Zito, read everything she writes. I'm Kurt Schlichter, guest hosting for the great Hugh Hewitt. Get my book. We'll be back. The Fall and Rise of America. And we'll be back here for two more hours of this madness. Stick around.
Fighting soldiers from the sky. Fearless men.
We're back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I'm retired United States Army Colonel Kurt Schlichter, guest hosting for the great Hugh Hewitt here in the Relief Factor studio. It is my distinct pleasure to bring on another Army 06. I believe you're an 06, Congressman Walsh. You an 06?
I am. The fighting colonels.
Oh, my gosh. You know, I got my promotion. I was like, God, they will promote anybody.
I just remember as a cadet looking at the colonel at VMI, colonels at VMI, and just thinking, God, am I ever going to be that old?
Yeah. Welcome to my world. I'm retired 7 years. Holy cow. I am super crusty. But of course, from my perspective, I now feel free to critique you guys who are still serving, and you're still serving in our reserves. You're also, incidentally, a congressman from Florida. So, you also, full disclosure, employ one of Hugh Hewitt's sons on your staff. First thing up, I want to lean heavily on your military side.
Sure.
We talked to a lot of politicians, but not a lot of politicians, frankly, know which part of the M4 goes bang. You do. And
yeah.
we're seeing a lot of things going on in Ukraine that a lot of folks have questions about. First of all, you're Special Forces. You're a Green Beret in civilian parlance. I was unspecial forces. I was an infantry brigade combat team. You were a scalpel. I was a sledgehammer. What can you explain to folks the difference between what Special Forces does and what line infantry armor maneuver forces do?
Yeah, sure. An infantry brigade combat team, which you were a part and led, is probably the best in the world, depending if they're light, meaning it's primarily soldiers, or heavy in their armored vehicles, at seizing and holding terrain. And that means if you have to seize it, you're going to go on the offense, you're going to take it from the bad guys, you're going to outmaneuver them, you're going to flank them, you're going to pound them in submission, and then you're going to hold that terrain in keeping with our strategic objectives. Special Forces, on the other hand, and particularly Army Special Forces, can do a couple of different things. But primarily, in a larger conventional fight, they operate behind enemy lines, where they can conduct sabotage operations, go after command and control, take down infrastructure. In the Cold War, they were intended to actually stay behind as the Russian horde, flowed through the Fulda Gap. And conduct those operations. But in recent decades, they've conducted, of course, counterinsurgency in Afghanistan and Iraq. But really, our true mission, our bread and butter, is training foreign militaries, whether that's a tribe or, in the case of Ukraine, their special forces and their military, in line with our objectives. And I think what you're seeing in Ukraine is 8 years of Green Berets showing them how to conduct guerrilla warfare, how to operate those javelins, how to command and control, shoot, move, and communicate. And I'm so proud of the training that my fellow Green Berets have provided the Ukrainians.
Well, hold on, Michael Walsh. As a former member of the Cal Army National Guard, we've been in Ukraine for nearly 25 years. I know I went four times myself. Spent a lot of time at Yarevov. And between the Green Beret trainers and the line unit trainers, mostly from the 79th Infantry Brigade Combat Team, which I was deputy commander and briefly acting commander of, we were able to really help the Ukrainians step up their game. Now, one of the things that we have seen in Ukraine is the fact that armor may not be the unstoppable iron fist that it used to be. Man-portable weapons, anti-tank weapons like the NLAWs or the Javelin systems in the hands of well-trained light infantry seems to be changing the whole calculus. What do you think of that? And what's that say about America's force posture, understanding that the Marines have themselves divested themselves of most of their armor?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think that's going to be debated and will be debated even on the Armed Services Committee where I sit as we start going through the Pentagon's budget. And in fairness, I was getting there with the National Guard. I'm a proud guardsman. I just visited the Florida National Guard in December, just before the
invasion.
Nice. That was out doing great work as well. But
yep.
On the armor piece, I think that's really debatable. And I take your point, but I think armor in an urban environment, badly coordinated, as armor has to be coordinated with infantry and has to be coordinated with close air support
and other fires.
And it has not been with the Russians and other fires, artillery as well. And it has been poorly resupplied. And the Russian armor, as we've seen since Desert Storm 1, really isn't that good. It was never intended to be that good. It was intended to be used in mass.
Yep.
And it was intended to use offensively, but the actual protection of the crew, while you're seeing these, people are seeing images of these turrets literally, popped off and flung tens of dozens of feet, is because the ammunition inside is so exposed. So once you penetrate that Russian armor, that crew is, literally is toast.
Well, in Desert Storm, yeah. Michael Walsh, several M1 tanks, American M1 tanks were hit. We still use the M1. No American soldier was killed inside an M1. There were some guys killed hanging out the turrets.
Right.
No one was killed inside. It's that much protection. And there are a bunch of systems, besides the armor, there are a bunch of systems designed to suppress fires and stuff.
I think the true test will be now in the rolling plains of eastern Ukraine, which will be different than what we saw in the north.
Yep.
That is armor country. But again, if the Russians employ it badly, then they're going to have an incredibly hard time.
The total lack of synchronization of the Russian attack, including the disastrous logistics, it really surprised me, Congressman Michael Walsh, who is also a United States Army colonel. Here's the indicator to me. Bad tires. Bad tires indicate bad maintenance and indicates no NCO, or in their case, junior officer leadership and possible corruption. In other words, you're spending money on tires somebody's pocketing instead, and your vehicle gets a flat 20 miles into the operation. I'm looking at this stuff and I'm thinking, holy cow. Back in the day when I was in the American military, this was its bread and butter. Being able to move, being able to resupply, being able to coordinate and integrate all the battlefield operating systems. Russians just couldn't pull it off.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I think now they've consolidated under one commander in the Eastern Military District, who was also the commander in Syria. They've consolidated their supply lines. They tried to do way too much over far too much geography. But they still have a very top-down, risk-adverse command and control system. Up until the consolidation under this commander, it went all the way back to Moscow. And you had various ministries and various commanders, stovepipe. And in a conscript army, in an army that's run like the Russians, where if you mess up, it's literally your head, everybody bucks the decision to the next higher level. And so when something doesn't go according to plan, which clearly it hasn't, everybody's kind of frozen in place, just marching along with that plan and scared to make a change. And I think you're seeing that play out logistically and operationally with the Russian military. And finally, I just want to say, look, General Milley and others are patting themselves on the back. They did in our hearing recently on how the intel got it right.
They didn't get it right. What the hell are they talking about?
Intel does a great job of counting planes, tanks, and ships, and seeing those move around the space. But in terms of capability, which is what you're getting to, morale, training, operations, maintenance, logistics, we got it way wrong,
well,
on the Ukrainian side and the Russian side.
Well, Congressman Michael Walsh, also a United States Army colonel. I'm a retired one. I have a bunch of questions I'd love to ask you, none of which are appropriate for an open source environment. and I think you know which ones I'd be talking
about.
Well, let's talk about what everybody sees, which is a map. And what I see is a giant salient pushed up against the Donbass, and I see Russian forces in the north and the south. It looks obvious to me, especially since it's tank country, that they're going to try and cut off those forwardly deployed Ukrainian forces. What the hell are the Ukrainians going to be able to do about that?
Yeah, that's it puts Zelensky in a very tough position. And I think this was always the plan. With Putin, what went incredibly sideways was that the surrounding of Kyiv and causing a collapse of the Zelensky government.
Yep.
But they've but the Ukrainians
clearly the objective.
They are not evenly spread across the country. About 75% of their army has been stacked in the east, and the Russians always wanted to cut them off, going to Kharkiv in the north, and then heading south and cutting them off. Some of the Ukrainian forces went from east to west to defend Kyiv. And the question for Zelensky is, does he leave them there? Do the Russians try to fix them in place? Or does he send them back east to head off this flanking maneuver? And that I can't get into open source, but that's the decision before him. And then separately, look, let's not overlook the sinking of the Moskva.
I was going to get to that. We got about 15 seconds. So
okay.
Talk about the significance of that, because I think it's very significant.
It is significant in that we're now seeing the entire Black Sea fleet, the Russian fleet, backing off of the coast.
Interesting.
And another key objective was Odessa. They should have had those missiles months ago. We should have provided them. Fortunately, they were able to utilize their own.
Excellent. Congressman Michael Walsh, a United States Army colonel, thank you for joining me on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. Eric Schmidt, the Attorney General of Missouri, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt
Good
radio program.
You. Good to be with you, Kurt.
Hey, I got to ask you, Attorney General Schmidt, how did you manage to get yourself such a boatload of money in the last after the last FCC revelations? I mean, it looks like your campaign is just going gangbusters.
Well, I think our message, Kurt, is really resonating. You and I had a chance to visit at CPAC and talk about what we were feeling on the ground. And I think that right now in Missouri, people want a fighter. They want somebody who's, been unafraid to take a blowtorch to this Biden agenda, whether it's on, the border security issues we've been in the lead on. We were the first state to file on the OSHA vaccine mandate one. Also unafraid to take on some of the petty tyrants in your own state, right? The folks who are forcing masking, CRT. We've opened up a parent or a student portal where they can submit this crazy stuff like the oppression matrix, and we can expose what's happening in our schools. And so I think that's what's really resonating. We've got supporters in every county. We've been very successful fundraising because I really believe that this is a fight to save America, that this election cycle really is going to determine if we remain the freest country in the history of the world, or we become something else. And that's why I'm running. And I think that's why we've gotten so much support.
Well, Attorney General Mike Schmidt, the Hugh Hewitt radio program typically does not take a position in conservative primaries. And you've got a couple of opponents who are, fairly regular conservatives, and you've got another one named Eric Greitens. And Eric Greitens was a disaster when about a year ago he came on with Hugh Hewitt. Now, Hugh is not a litigator. I am. I take depositions. I go to court and try cases. But Hugh just disassembled this guy brutally, and he totally fell apart. Yet Eric Greitens still maintains a position in this race. And I'm wondering, are the people of Missouri capable of nominating the one guy who can lose this race in the general?
I think once this race starts becoming more and more dynamic, because right now a lot of the polling is name ID, of course, in which I'm very thankful that we're in the lead. But I think having those resources, obviously, as I mentioned, will be important to tell the story about how, hey, we are fighting for Missourians against government overreach at the federal level and the local level. But once the race becomes more dynamic, I think once more people are aware or reminded of really who he is. And quite frankly, it's a 50-50 Senate. There are no mulligans here. We cannot lose a race in November that we should win like Missouri, because the Democrats are playing for keeps. You know, they want to pack the court. They want to add states to the union. They want to federalize our elections, fundamentally change this country forever. And so we can't, you know, I've been on record with the latest allegations and revelations and sworn affidavit from his ex-wife. Eric Greitens should get out of this race. But he's in. But I'm confident the people of Missouri will send the real conservative fighter. And I think that based on the support we've gotten, people understand that that's me.
Well, Attorney General Eric Schmidt, the fact with a guy like Greitens, and I don't want to spend a lot of time talking about him, but I think it's important. Let's assume everything. He's got an excuse for everything. And let's assume those excuses are true. Who cares? This is about winning the election. This is about what you just said, which is preserving the United States of America in a form that is not alien and repellent to us. And I don't understand why he, who was a fellow commission officer in the United States, is putting his own personal desire and his own personal needs up against this important objective. Because whether it's fair or not, and we don't even need to go down that road. He is damaged goods, and he is the only candidate who does not, who provides a chance for the Democrats to take this seat. I just don't get it. Is that resonating with the, is that disconnect resonating with the Missouri, electorate?
Well, I think his numbers, based on the most recent polling, would indicate, that his numbers are dropping pretty dramatically, and our numbers were on the rise as we lead the race. And so, that's going to continue to be my focus, delivering that message. But I mean, this the sworn affidavit from the ex-wife, and not even talking about the stuff you mentioned from a few years ago, is they're disgusting allegations about abuse. As a Missouri attorney general, as the top prosecutor in the state, I know a predator when I see one. I put predators behind bars. He needs to just get out of this race. But we're going to keep running the race and telling our story. And it's a record of not just talking about things, Kurt, because a lot of people can do that.
Yep.
It's about action and results. And I'm never going to quit on the state. And that's what people want right now, the fighter who's going to go fight and win.
Well, Eric Schmidt, you have managed to use your position as an attorney general to actively exercise its powers in the pursuit of conservative objectives. And we see so often Republicans who are afraid to exercise the power that they've been granted by the voters. The Missouri voters asked you to go out and defend their interests, and you've been doing that in court. Why do you think so many Republicans don't follow your example and do what we sent them to do using the powers we entrusted them with?
Well, I think it's true with a lot of office holders. It's sometimes, I guess, they like going to the ribbon cuttings and giving the speeches, and those things are sometimes more comfortable. But when our country's on the line, which it is right now, there's no question about it. I mentioned what the Democrats want to do. They're two votes away from doing all of that, by the way. The most probably tenuous time in our nation's history, in modern history, as far as changing the republic fundamentally forever, right? And they also want to teach our kids to despise America. I mean, they are playing for keeps. And so, you know, we've been on the front lines fighting these important fights. I mean, you know, we talked about that OSHA vaccine mandate, what that meant for the massive expanse of an agency that was meant to make sure forklifts beep when they back up, somehow compelling, you know, a medical procedure on 100 million Americans. I mean, this stuff is crazy. I mean, you talk about what's happened at the border now, Kurt. I mean, Missouri was the first state to file with Texas on the Remain in Mexico issue that President Trump had that was very successful. We took that all the way to Supreme Court. We won. We were the first state to file with Texas to finish the border wall, right? There's money that's been appropriated by Congress, and Joe Biden literally is paying contractors to not construct the wall where the materials are sitting on the ground. And then just 2 weeks ago, Missouri, Arizona, and Louisiana filed a lawsuit against, you know, Joe Biden's reversal of Title 42, which will unleash a tsunami of illegal immigration. It accounts for about 50% of the expulsions right now at the border. You're talking about 500,000 a month, you're talking about, if you extrapolate that over Joe Biden's time in office, he will have led in, that we know of, 30 million illegal immigrants. That is the state of Texas. That is five Missouris. They're not messing around. We have to win these lawsuits, and that's why we're pushing so hard, because the stakes are so high.
Well, Attorney General Eric Schmidt, here's what I think is interesting about our talk. You are talking about subjects that a lot of Republicans are not comfortable with. Every Republican is comfortable about talking about Joe Biden's inflation. And every Republican is comfortable talking about the economy. And those are important to you, and I know they're important to the folks in the Show Me State. But you're bringing up some social issues, some cultural issues, the culture warrior issues that we're told we're not supposed to talk about, yet you're talking about them, and I can only assume that's because you, with your finger on the pulse of what actual voters are concerned with, is seeing that out there. In 30 seconds, tell me, why is it so important to talk about these issues?
Because this country was founded on the principle that individuals have rights, and they come from God, and they don't come from some government or some king or some queen. And government's only job is to protect those God-given rights. That's my job. My job is to make sure that that great experiment, that beautiful experiment of self-government, where we believe in these rights, survives. And that's why I'm running for the United States Senate. And all issues are on the table.
Thank you, Eric Schmidt of Missouri, running for U.S. Senate. Give him a look. I'm Kurt Schlichter. We will be right back with more stuff on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. We're back on the Hugh Hewitt radio program. I am guest host Kurt Schlichter, senior columnist at townhall.com, retired United States Army colonel. And a noted Los Angeles trial lawyer, as is my next guest. At least that's the context I met him in before he became what is arguably the best national security advisor in American history. Robert O'Brien. Robert, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt radio program.
Great to be with you, Kurt, and thank you for that kind introduction.
Oh, you know, I'm looking at what's happening in Ukraine. And I look how you handled, as the last national security advisor for President Trump, a variety of challenges. And, you know, you guys got a Middle East peace deal. You got the Serbs and the and Kosovo to something like peace. You guys got NATO to at least start contributing. I mean, you had successes around the globe. I don't think this Ukraine thing would have happened if Putin had been facing a Donald Trump administration with a Robert O'Brien as a national security advisor. Am I wrong?
Well, I don't think so. I think what you can do is just look at the record of accomplishments that President Trump achieved. I mean, it was pretty simple. It goes back to Ronald Reagan, and you're a student of Roman history, and it goes back to the Roman times, peace through strength works. And I used to tell this to my staff at the NSC very often, a weakness in international affairs and even the perception of weakness. I don't think America is weak. I think America is fundamentally a strong country and remains so, notwithstanding some of our divisions and some of the poor policy choices that are being made. We're fundamentally a strong country. But if we're perceived by our adversaries as being weak, that's provocative. And they'll engage in adventures and take actions that are detrimental, not just to us, but our partners and allies. We've seen that with Afghanistan. We've seen it with Ukraine. And hopefully we will not see it with Taiwan. But it's a dangerous time, because I believe our adversaries perceive us to be weak, even if we're, even though we remain a fundamentally strong country.
Well, Robert O'Brien, I think that's an absolutely correct analysis. We saw just this weekend the North Koreans tested off a new type of missile in response to American South Korean exercises. And right now, in negotiations with the Iranians, it appears that the Biden administration wants to give away the whole store.
Well, the Obama administration had very few accomplishments, but one of the accomplishments that the administration believed was quite significant was the JCPOA, the nuclear deal with Iran. That was a terrible deal at the time. The the assumption and the thesis that they had is that if they eliminated sanctions on Iran and gave Iran $150 billion in sanctions relief, paid them a lot of cash in settling claims and went back to the time that the Shah fell and got a few hostages home, that the Iranians would become, quote, responsible stakeholders in the Middle East, that peace would break out, and that this money would go to somehow would go to the Iranian middle class and the Iranians would become more peaceful and responsible partners. In fact, what happened is that $150 billion was spent corruptly by the regime, and what wasn't stolen was given to terrorists, Houthis in Yemen, Khatib Hezbollah in Iraq, Hezbollah in Lebanon, the Assad regime, and Hamas in Gaza. And so the thesis was turned out to be utterly wrong and false and was demonstrably so. And that's why we ended in the Trump administration, ended the JCPOA and went to a policy of maximum pressure on Iran. But again, there's this desire to restore an accomplishment for President Obama. Whatever the outcome is, they want this JCPOA. They want it badly. And they're going to give Iran whatever it takes to get it. It's an unfortunate situation.
Well, Robert O'Brien, former national security advisor to President Reagan, we've still got almost 3 years of this guy in the White House, and who knows what mischief he can make during that time. Tell me about, we're going to have a new president in 2024, and I think it's going to be a Republican, considering the track record of failure that Joe Biden has laid for us. What is the Republican agenda, no matter who the president is, for foreign policy once we take back the reins of government?
Well, Gert, the first thing we have to do is rebuild the military, and that's something we were doing under President Trump. We've got to give our war fighters, and you were one of them, and deployed, I know, overseas, and did so under admirable circumstances. And the last war we decisively won in Gulf One. We've got to give our war fighters the platforms and the weapons they require to defend themselves and defend us and keep us safe. I mean, we've got a defense budget now, which technically is an increase in the defense budget, but with of 3 or 4%, but with a 10% inflation rate, it's actually a decrease of 6 to 7%.
Well, that's Ambassador O'Brien, that a real decrease in the military budget isn't going to work. We've got about 15 seconds left. Are you going to run for governor of Utah? Say yes. Say yes. Say yes.
I'm not, but there's some great folks up there who I'm sure will. I'm sure the folks in Utah good Republican state.
Well, thank you, Ambassador Robert O'Brien. And thank you, listeners. Thank you, Hewitt Radio Program. I'm guest host Kirk Schlichter. I'll be back tomorrow. So I'll see you all then. Bye-bye.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.